Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Good evening and welcome to the September 2015 episode of the Three Horsemen. Yes, we're back, and if you didn't find out last month, we are now on iTunes as well. I'm Fred Kish, found on Twitter as @FredKish, and my blog is Bernal Alpha, and I'm occasionally on Facebook, mostly under other names. But here I am tonight under my own name with my two co-hosts, so please say hello to John Stevens.
Hello to that guy. I am John Stevens. I am a writer and occasional blogger and columnist for SF Signal, and I can be found on Twitter as Erudite Ogre, and my blog is a vast wasteland at the moment, so we'll just move on.
And also joining us tonight, as always, is Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hey, Jeff Patterson here, JeffPatterson11 on Twitter. I blog at GraviLens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. Haven't done much for SF Signal lately, aside from this podcast, but I got a couple things coming up.
And our special fourth horse tonight is a man who will never turn down a cup of coffee in the town of Princeton, Mr. Joe Monty.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, sure. Thank you, sir. So, Joe, we wanted to have you on because not only because you're in the same time zone as us and nearly the same town as me, but
high criteria.
Well,
you'd be shocked, huh?
Yes. It's a low bar to get on the show. What can I say? We've even had Jeff Patterson on. So, yeah. I mean, Patrick Hester and everybody. So, you know, what can I say? But we wanted to talk to you because you have worn many hats in the industry, starting, if I remember correctly, as a small B bookseller, then a large B bookseller, agent, I assume at some point editor, and now publisher. And our theme kind of this year has been, we've been talking with Irene Gallo as an art director. We talked to Elisa last month of 12th Manit as a both a podcaster and a publisher and an editor. So we wanted to continue the theme with yet another industry member and an industry great. So welcome.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and then the last piece with Krandestein was really well done. She's so bright.
Yep.
She's doing a lot of really interesting things.
Yes, she is.
Yes.
You got a lot of feedback on that too. So.
Oh yeah, good.
So, growing up in whatever small rural town that you lived in, were you a genre fan?
Yeah, no, I grew up in Yonkers, which is pretty good from play now on HBO because
David Simon's the farmlands of Yonkers. Yes.
Yeah, the racist pit of a town of 150,000 people. And like I was saying, David Simon's new mini-series, so to speak, I think it's a mini-series on HBO, was dealing with a period of time that I was there in Yonkers, with the racism going on there. Yeah, the public school system in Yonkers, just to go off topic, is actually still segregated. Lovely. But yeah, going back to topic, I think the first thing I read was a James Hogan Giants novel that my uncle gave me, and it was the third book in the series. Uh-huh. And it was impenetrable until I realized, oh, it's the third book in the series. And the next thing I remember, that's adult at least, was the Robot series from Asimov, and then from there I went to Dune. But yeah, no, that was 12, 13. So back in the BBS days, I was a freak on bulletin boards like the Kiwisatz Haderach and and Milly Ways and stuff like that. So, yeah, my geek flag has always been flying.
And I know that you became a big B bookseller, but did you start out as a small B bookseller?
Yeah, I started off in high school, working at a B Dalton in Yonkers, and then stayed there a while, and then eventually ran that store until it ran out. And then I became a buyer for Barnes & Noble for about 11 years. And then from there, I became a sales rep. I sold to Baker & Taylor and to Barnes & Noble. And then I that was for Houghton Mifflin right before the merger. And then I became an editor at Little Brown for a little while. And then I became an agent for about 5 years. And then this happened, where I am now editorial director of Saga Press. And it is absolutely my dream job.
So you can't hold the job is what you're saying.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I just kept, you know, this was actually the goal. Right. Back when I was 31, when I knew enough to kind of know in the industry, like, okay, you know, someday I want to try to get my own imprint. I mean, that would be really cool. And I started making a career plan for myself, and none of it panned out. And as sometimes these things go, it's the odd path that ends up leading back to where you wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with me.
So you're, I mean, as an editor and a publisher, you're kind of aligned on the same end of the field, but you were also an agent. So, I mean, do you think that helped you ultimately as a publisher?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think all the different – I can look back in hindsight and see all the dotted lines that the book selling helps tremendously. Being an agent also helps. I mean, with my negotiations with other agents and not just the basic familiarity with contracts and stuff like that, but also how the field is, how to work with folks. You know, I think – seeing how hard it is on the other side, and it's really hard to be an agent. You have a sense of appreciation, which I hope manifests itself when dealing with other agents and authors, of course. You know, I appreciate what they have to go through, and also what I can try to do to make Saga a little better, mm-hmm. and not just have a certain perspective.
Okay, so let's talk about Saga. What's
yeah, I mean, that's all generalizations, but you know, we can get into whatever you want, you know.
Yep. No, so what is Saga?
It's Simon & Schuster's first fantasy science fiction imprint in 32 years, 33 years, something like that. I'm sorry, say that again?
I said that long?
Yeah, no, it. The whole history is... I'm going to mess this up a little bit, so Hartwell and John Douglas will have to forgive me, but it was either 81 or 82 when David Hartwell and John Douglas, primarily David, started the imprint at S&S, and it went away after a couple of years, and John went off, I think, directly to Harper, I could be wrong, and David... I think went somewhere else before Tor, but I could be wrong about that too.
I was at Pocket for Timescape for a while.
Well, that was the imprint actually.
Okay, sorry.
That was Timescape, yeah.
Okay.
And so then that went away, and then Jim Bain came in and made a deal with Simon & Schuster. And 30-odd years later, there was room. The short version of this is that post-Book Apocalypse 2009, and that Book Apocalypse was when, as you may be familiar, John, when ebooks started to rise and the economy mm-hmm. went down, and
yep.
it all conflated together, and it was the end of the world once again for book publishing, and which happens every 10 to 12 years.
Exactly. It's a cycle.
Right. And at the end of that, what was working? Children's YA and the genres, mystery, romance, fantasy, science fiction. And one of the division heads at Simon & Schuster, John Anderson, he had the idea like, well, you know, we don't do this here. We should do it. I mean, he's always been a fan. And John and I have known each other for 20 years. And he asked me, and I didn't believe it would happen, and it did. And here I am. So I started the imprint actually 2 years ago this November. It'll be 2 years that I started Simon & Schuster, but the first book's launched just this February.
Right. And is there a theme or, well, I guess theme is probably the word I'm looking at for, but.
Are you going to say vision?
Well, I'm trying to avoid the corporate
stuff
I hear every day, you know. Yeah. But is there a vision then? If you use that word? Let's go California.
You know, honestly, I don't like vision either. No, but I have a lot of schemes.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond the schemes themselves, I also, like, I'm not good about tuning my own horn, sorry. I have one superpower in this industry, and that's pattern recognition. I'm really good at it. It got honed when I was a buyer, and so I trust that instinct, and I kind of use that as a barometer or a compass, I guess is better, for where I want to acquire and how I want to shape the imprint. Mm-hmm. And so I have thoughts. If you want to go into that now.
No, sure. Why not?
I mean, when I started...
Wherever you want to take us.
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I was a big believer, and still am, that we're heading towards a revitalization of science fiction, particularly space opera. And where the industry was 2 years ago, there was no way. Because it wasn't selling. It wasn't selling.
All fantasy.
Yeah, it was all fantasy, and it was particularly grimdark, which, sidebar, I never believed in, and as a real trend. And so I thought we were going towards space opera, so I was looking for that, and it was a bit scarce when I started. It's more populous now, but even so, it's not as much as you would expect. And I also think we're going towards a different direction, fantasy. I also, which I can get into later too, but the other big thing is women and a female audience and attracting a larger female audience to the field. We obviously have one, but I don't think in general we've been very good about attracting more. As in, again, gross generalizations, but... generally, women read more fiction than men, or predominantly women read more fiction than men. And we don't publish a lot of women very well in the industry, and so I've been trying to tailor that. There's some personal motivations there, but it's also just, I think, good business. And along with that is a broader spectrum of who we publish, you know, people of color, different facets, different voices. And I think all of that is important. And it's also just smart business. When you look at the comic industry, which is probably the most, or at least was the most sexist industry, where you're literally depicting women badly. You know, it's changed in the past 2 years, where you have things like Lumberjanes and Captain Marvel selling so well. And there were recent reports that the industry has grown as much as 40% to 45% in the past couple of years, mm-hmm. because now women are reading it. Shocking. And so that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like, I think once we can tailor some books that are more suited, then we can grow the audience, which is what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like the big overview.
I thought this week we got a big revelation that women don't write science fiction, but maybe that person was wrong.
Oh, who said that?
I was a reviewer of a all women anthology. I believe it was an all women space opera anthology.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And several thousand people, I believe, commented to him that he was mistaken. So that quote unquote best selling author has been schooled badly.
Well, good.
Gentlemen, any questions?
Well, I was just going to observe that I think the line as it's come out so far and what's coming up ahead really actually reflects what you just said really strongly. There are a lot of women authors. There's a nice variety too in what you're putting out.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I was just looking over some of the stuff you've got coming up and stuff you put out, and it's really impressive that you've got a mix of, you know, sort of classical science fiction, fantasy, some more out front stuff, and a few really kind of daring things like Nnedi Okorafor's Lagoon, which is great. It's a great book, and it's very daring in what it does.
And it was so I was actually fantasy, mm-hmm. science fiction, and horror all together.
Exactly. Yeah, she really doesn't settle on a genre per se, even though it's sort of about an alien invasion. But
right, so it's this one's more science fiction. Some of her other stuff is more fantasy. But
yeah, but she's always been one who mixes stuff up like that. I mean, Who Fears Death was like that. And
right.
So, but I mean, overall, you've got a really interesting mix, and you've got people from Linda Nagata and Chuck Wendig to. You got Stina Light's new book, and it's just really great to see the mix that you've been able to put forth, and it also all seems at the same time focused. Like, you're not trying to play the field widely; you're just finding a mix of stuff that really works.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm also working with fellow editor Nava Wolf,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, we're trying, you know. I mean, it's, I think these first couple of years, it's been me going after a couple of people, but also not in a poaching way. I mean, just like, okay, who's got something that's around? But also trying to pick quality, because that I can control rather than,
sure.
You know, you always hope something breaks out, but it's been a weird year, mm-hmm. largely. 15, nothing, a lot of things haven't broken us out of, fortunately, Grace of Kings and you know, some established authors, and one book in particular, which we should talk about later. But but the quality I can control. I mean, you know, Nava can mm-hmm. control about, like, okay, we can go high end, mm-hmm. and show that we have a range. Like, so, yeah.
And I like how you sort of brought Joanne M. Harris into the fold too.
Yeah, no, that book is,
you know, not a typical person you think of as a genre writer.
Right. Yeah. No. And she's a total dork. I spent it was a great time. We did a pre-pub tour in last March in California, or I should say the West Coast. So I spent 5 days with her and Ken Liu on airplanes and in the car with me driving, and yeah, no, she's totally one of us and has been for a while. It wasn't a stretch
mm-hmm.
for her.
Sure.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, that's great.
But I was going to say something. Oh, but whatever. Go on.
What I really find interesting about, I mean, this might tie back to the industry trends. I mean, you launched when doom and gloom was all the rage for the book industry. So to launch a new line was pretty an amazing, you know, commitment on the part of the publisher. Have things improved since then, or are we still in a slower downward slope, or, you know, what do you see?
Well, I'm always, my glass is always half full, but specifically for Saga, we're hitting our early numbers, which is great. But you know, the overall industry, it's been a soft year. It's been a soft year. I don't think it's particularly because the industry isn't doing well or something that you can really point to. I think in general, the fantasy and science fiction field is finding its new way. It was heavily focused in one direction, and it's transitioning towards something new. And what's exciting about that is that you can try to find that what that new thing is. And we're not programmed into a sort of 2006 to 2010 paradigm of paranormal urban fantasy. So you can have a lot of room on the shelf for different kinds of things and see what works. But, you know, for breakouts, it's been harder. a lot of publishers have been struggling, but there's also been a lot of really interesting things if you just look at even what's coming out this past month or what's coming in the next couple of weeks. A lot of things that you wouldn't expect as fall releases. And I think that's great. It's great. And I'm speaking specifically of Alia de Bedard's novels and Cho's books. I just picked up, we'll talk about this later, but Nora Jemison's new book today. And, you know, I think these things are great that we have this range, but also that there's this possibility of different things that could connect. To your specific point, no, I don't think it's doom and gloom at all.
Well, do you think enough other publishers have seen that, for example, as you mentioned, specifically in comics, more women are involved, therefore they're starting to change their lines to attract more than just the three aging hosts of this podcast?
Well, I don't think you guys would probably just read that way anyway either. I think it's actually more of having the almost allowance to do so. I mean, without calling anyone out, I mean, I know specific editors who have always wanted to do this, or specific editors who always have. It's just like now maybe don't get more attention or feel more freedom to do so. And, in that case, yes, I do think we're changing. And when Sorcerer to the Crown is one of the lead titles for Ace, that's awesome. That's cool.
I had a question. You when you were talking about space opera in particular, and I'm just kind of curious because I've been I'm in the midst of valiantly attempting trying to write one right now, and so I've been kind of avoiding them because I don't want to have subconscious influence, whatever. And I've mentioned before these two nut jobs have had me reading outside my comfort zone for quite a while now. So, but I am kind of curious on specifically the space opera landscape. Are there any things that are occurring now that are either unexpected or that really sort of run counter to the traditional tropes and shapes of the books that are being produced?
Well, you know, I think we're ramping up, honestly. I mean, this is some scrying, if you will, on my half. But so you got The Expanse, right, which has worked.
Yeah.
And that science, as Daniel has said, it's plausible. You know, it's not full space opera. But I think it's got the tone of space opera in many ways. So you've got The Expanse coming on TV at the end of the year. You have a Star Wars movie every year for the next 6 years. You've got Ventures coming. You've got Childhood's End. You've got Foundation. There's The Old Man's War. There's Gateway. What else am I missing? There's Margaret Atwood's trilogy. And this is a range of science fiction I'm talking about, right, obviously. But when you go back a couple of years just to Guardians of the Galaxy working, that should not have worked at all. I remember sitting at the theater like, wow, we went there. We went full space opera, and we haven't done full space opera in like 30 years in the theater. And everyone bought in, and they bought in largely because of Chris Pratt's charm. But still, you could have bounced off that movie really hard. And no one did. I think it's because it's part of the culture now. We all accept it. There are generations of people now who've been exposed to it and aren't afraid. And as far as more rigorous science fiction, I think that's still going to be very difficult. But where we're going, that's on the shelves. It's not there yet. Where we're going to be in 16, I think there's going to probably be a couple of breakouts. And then 16 and the 17 is where you're really going to see it.
Nice.
And, you know, particularly if we get something like epic fantasy in space. That's something I'm very attracted to that I want to get. And I happen to. So, you know, Dune. or depending on how you want to look at it, the Dragon Rider books from McCaffrey, you know, I mean, it's, she wrote them as science fiction novels. They're accepted as fantasy, you know, but I think that kind of thing, it, if somebody makes a good one, that's going to be the big breakout.
And it's a good thing you've got some of those Dragon Rider books in the lineup, too.
Yeah, well, that was one of the first things, like, when I started, I'm like, these haven't been in, published in adult in 30-odd years, you know? I think 1985. I think exactly. It's when Del Rey had them. They were last in print, somewhere around then in 85. And so long overdue. Long overdue.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah, and we had fun. You know, I got new introductions, and I don't know if you've seen these, but these loving introductions. The first one, Tammy Pierce. I picked Tammy because she worked with Jean Carl, and Jean Carl was the one who had Athenaeum, and Jean worked with not only Tammy, but Le Guin on Earthsea, and McCaffrey on the Harper Hall books, and so many other great things. And I wanted that as a touchstone. And then, of course, Naomi Novik and Brandon Sanderson.
Yep.
And they wrote these really heartfelt introductions to each book. And, you know, we put Stephen Martinier covers on it. And Anway, I think, would have been happy with the dragons he illustrated. They don't look like dragons. They look like lizards. So, yeah. I mean, just even little things like that, you know, just makes me happy. Because there's the through line, right, from the 70s to now. And I think that kind of thing is important.
Oh, yeah. So,
but yeah, space opera.
Space opera. I can see Grand Scope with Ken Liu. More military SF with Linda.
Yeah, and the Dark Side Wars, somewhere between military SF and space opera.
Mm-hmm. Even Anne McCaffrey is more space opera in some ways, just based on one planet.
Oh, yeah. Now, well, again, so you know, she thought they were science fiction novels.
Yeah, yeah. I still have that issue of Analog, rather, I think it was at that point. Mr. Stevens, back to you. Or
okay. I'm interested in the career path that you had seems to have actually almost accidentally prepared you for what you're doing now.
Right? I know.
And so what do you actually feel you employ from those previous jobs that you apply to what's going on right now in terms of sort of prognosticating and also trying to map out a strategy for the imprint?
All the time, especially the book-selling elements. I think the other things are more subtle. You know, and yeah, it's some of it's dated, of course. You know, I haven't been a bookseller for a while, but I left Barnes & Noble in 2006. But the elements of that are still really important. You know, you keep current by looking at the shelves and what's selling and how it's selling. And I think, you know, being able to see how the sausage is made, let alone make the sausage now, and knowing how it is at the ground level are all really, really important aspects. And so, you know, I think, so for example, Lend of the God is how we're treating the red. Had different ways to go at it. And I definitely wanted the sequel to it, The Trials, which came out a month ago almost. To be really close on the heels of the reissue of The Red. And because that got nominated for the Nebula, the John W. Campbell Memorial Award. And, you know, one of those people who are waiting for book two to have that immediate satisfaction, the folks who read the first one, they're like, no, they're like, okay, you can just jump right in and keep going. And then once we did that, like, what do you think? Should we do the third one kind of right away or not? And Linda was game for it. And, some other series have worked really well by having that kind of momentum. So we decided to go for it. And, you know, I talked to booksellers and I remember my own experiences and I'm like, well, okay, yeah, you can build something, even though it's been a while since The Red came out. to keep this momentum going. And so Bookselling was a big part of that decision. And Linda is such a professional. She's been such a joy to work with. I remember once she emailed apologizing that she was going to turn in something a day before the deadline. And I'm like, she's great. She's great.
Day before. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
And they're so tight, too. I mean, yeah, the edits have been very specific, but, like, not. She's such a good writer. So it's been a real pleasure to work with her. But, yeah, so that's one example of the Bookselling. But the Bookselling comes into play a lot, a lot. The agenting is more subtle. It's more about the interactions, knowing how the industry works from all ends. And so does my time as a sales rep. You know, being able to talk to sales. A big part of my job of running the imprint is being able to sell the books internally. And knowing, I think there's a camaraderie there between the sales force and me, because some of them I know well from my buying days, and the others, they know that I know what I'm talking about. So when I say something, I'm not just pulling it out of the air. Like, yeah, no, I've done what you've done. I understand. So I think this is kind of an angle you can come at with this. So that's helpful. Yeah, so a lot of different aspects of it.
I can almost see Bookselling as being the place where you got most of your skills, though. I mean, you're selling books internally within the company. You're selling books at conventions. You're selling books right now on a podcast. You're even selling books to the authors to say, you know, hey, Linda, you know, how about a second one? How about a third one?
Yeah, no, right. You know, it's all about that kind of conversation. I think that natural dialogue that you can have either between books from different authors. And again, this gets into the whole pattern recognition thing. You know, I see it at different levels and how one thing interrelates to another. So to be specific there, okay, so here's my grim dark thing. taking George R. R. Martin out of the equation, and I know that's a big one to take out, but he's hit that rare phenomenon status, and it's too much to even attach anything to as it's gotten so big. So take him out. So what else, even if you were to label Grimdark, and I wouldn't, but take him out. What else has worked? Who's the biggest author?
Well, I'm going to guess Joe Abercrombie.
I think it's Joe, too. I think Joe is, I like to call him, he's like the Quentin Tarantino of fantasy. He's violent and smart and funny and really entertaining. And he's got a lot of qualities that make his books work. And they sell well. And then after Joe, you have a couple people pop up here or there. Not in a sustained way. And then that's it. You've got a lot of other kind of middle-of-the-road things that have worked, some better than others. But not something strong enough where you can say, okay, this is defined. Look at this, and then look what's branched out from there. So then you look at what else has worked. What else has worked in the last 10 years in a big way?
A lot of urban fantasy.
Well, besides that, though, I mean, I'm not even going to go there, but yes, absolutely. But I was thinking of Pat Rothfuss and Brandon Sanderson.
But I would have put them in many ways into Grimdark.
Really?
Just as I would put Glenn Cook as being
Grimdark's Glenn Cook's the father.
Yeah, forefather even before George Martin came into it.
Yeah, totally.
So
those books are great. Yeah. Yeah, but I think really Pat as Grimdark. Tell me.
The length of the book, the amount of details in the books.
Yeah,
I'm talking about the big ones, not the more YA or.
Yeah, but let's stay on Rothfuss.
Yeah,
but really,
yep.
Wow,
it's just but my definition probably of Grimdark is probably a lot looser than yours, mostly partly because my definition of fantasy tends to be a lot more slippery than a lot of people. I mean, I call Glenn Cook an urban fantasy writer in many ways, because if you look at the one series, Garrett, you know, it's, if it were not taking place in a fantasy world, you could put Garrett in the same world that is inhabited by Butcher.
Absolutely.
With Dresden or whatever. So, I mean, I would put Butcher into Grimdark many ways, as well as urban fantasy. Same with Cook, same with Rothfuss, same with several others. Sanderson, who's Mike Cole's buddy that's got like 19 books out at this point.
Yeah, Pete.
Yeah.
Peter Brett.
Right. Right. Even Mike Cole I would put into Grimdark in many ways.
Wow.
But that's why you're the bookseller and I'm not.
Yeah, everyone's in the boat with you. Wow. Yeah, I'm splitting hairs. I'm splitting hairs with scalpels.
If not to interrupt your train of thought, but if that's your take on it, Joe, I'm kind of curious, given how much the percentage of fandom, which seems to, and I'm talking strictly fandom, not so much the authors, but the percentage of fandom that seems to be flying the Grimdark banner, and if the landscape is that sparse, aside from these really, really high peaks that are undeniable, where is it coming from?
Exactly.
I mean,
so my counterpoint in a general sense, we can get specific if you really want to go there, but in a general sense, Pat, to me, I think he nailed that 17 to 19 year old male voice of a very intelligent guy who's just finding his way into adulthood. And that carries over into his fantasy world, which is this beautifully written thing. And the quote parts when he's an older man, I think he's only like in his 30s, but you know, they come in so sparsely that it's really just about that younger voice. And I think that's a certain kind of fantasy that you don't see a lot of, and it's very altruistic. And I think Brandon is very epic, and you know, all the world building elements aside, just his characters, there isn't a lot of gray, and I don't mean this in any kind of negative way. I think, do you know who stands on which side? And people like this, and I think the focus has been misdirected for a while, and so that's where I'm going in a general sense. And like that, those are like the big guys who've stood out. I mean, I think other people are being attributed to Grimdark that aren't Grimdark, who have also sold very well. So I think Pete Brett's hard. He mixes in elements of horror to his, so it could be seen that way. But he's really written a kind of straightforward fantasy in many ways with the horror elements in there. So I don't know if he's exactly Grimdark. But then Scott Lynch is such a great writer. He's writing really smart sword and sorcery. Oh my, his name went out of my head. But yeah, him.
oh yeah, him, right, yeah.
Yes. Oh, shame on me. This is why you can see I'm tired. But there's another author who's really successful, and his first trilogy of Orbit had the assassin. He was the assassin's apprentice, and this is killing me. It's really bad for a podcast. But anyway,
It's on the tip of my tongue too. Now I'm like,
yeah, him. Brent. No. Yeah, Brent Weeks.
Okay.
There we go. I just gave birth. And yeah, on the surface, you can see, okay, he's an assassin, he's an apprentice to assassins. But once you get into that book, you realize, like, oh, no, these are good guys in a really bad world. And it becomes a kind of more traditional heroic fantasy in many ways. And, you know, and he's succeeded very well with other heroic kind of fantasy stuff. And so I think he's the probably the biggest breakout outside of Brandon and Pat in the last 10 years. So you look at that and like, okay, where are we? And then you look at somebody like Naomi Novik. It's been a lot of historically based stuff, right? But then her new book is the one that I think is a bellwether. So Uprooted.
Mm-hmm.
It got a lot of great reviews, and it's a great book. And it's also very positive. Some happy ending stuff. And yeah, it's a one-off. And she's very established. But this book has sold really, really well. Why it didn't hit the bestseller lists? The bestseller lists are a weird thing, but the numbers are really strong. So it's actually one of the best-selling fantasy novels of the year. It's just been a little bit under the radar, which has been interesting. But with it being under the radar, it's selling so strongly, and I think that says a lot. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of other things have sold well and had their moments and then gone back to where they are. And this doesn't. It keeps going. Why? Not just because it's a great book, because it's a great book, yes, but I think there's something else. And this is what I think that something else is, that we're actually have an audience that's looking for more heroic, positive fantasy, for lack of a better term, and not grim dark.
Mm.
So that's the call.
All right, I have to ponder this now, because I'm thinking back to last Halloween when we had David Annandale on, and we were talking about the various thinly sliced subgenres of horror.
Oh, I know.
That sort of dominated the landscape, you know, for a long period of time, and now I got to think about that along the lines of fantasy as well. So.
I think Brian Staveley's done very well, and he's written heroic fantasy.
Do you see, going back to David Annandale in horror, I forget exactly when in the 80s it was, but there was like a tremendous implosion at one point on horror because it was so much out there, and then the music stopped. Do you think that's going to happen to fantasy? Grim dark or any shade thereof?
I think Grimdark, it already happened.
Okay.
It's obviously happened to a certain degree of paranormal romance and urban fantasy, but I think there are nuances there, too, that Belay, actually, it imploding completely the way horror did. So do we have the dearth of titles like we used to? No, and I think that's a good thing. But the books that are selling better, largely. They're peaking a little higher. Even really established folks are selling better, and not just like at a higher peak and for a shorter period of time. Butcher's still selling X, but now it's X in 3 weeks instead of 5 weeks. These people are doing better overall, and so I think that says that there's actually an audience for this, and now they're finding people that they didn't read before because they're not being hit with 20 titles a month. So I think that actually there's a through line there that urban fantasy, paranormal romance will continue.
Okay.
I don't think it's dead as it's been reported. So it's still hard. It's not as easy as it was, but well, to publish successfully.
Plus the e-books, I would imagine that it's the same thing with television, and more channels can now call a smaller audience a success because they're dealing with smaller budgets and smaller target demographics and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Where you could never have pulled that off when it was even 10 years ago, you couldn't have pulled that off in TV. I think the same thing's happening in books, where you're seeing these e-books that have a bit more of a targeted demographic that they're kind of aiming for.
And yeah, sure. Annie Ballet.
They're going to bleed past that.
She's done well. Marco Cluse has done well with his military SF / space opera. Yeah. And others. Also, I think, certain subgenres also trend more towards e-books in general anyway. Military science fiction is one of them. So where the e-book numbers are stronger than print. So I think there's a lot of little subtleties that you can look at if you're looking at the patterns of the numbers and what do you see. And, you know, if you have enough data points, then this may be true. So, yeah.
Okay. Anything that that we've not neglected to talk about that you want to speak about before we... Well, no, you wanted to talk about trends. I wasn't sure if we got everything that you wanted to speak of. And you kind of mentioned specific titles a few times, but then you, I think you want to talk about them as having been read for the second half of the show. So, you know.
Yeah, well, those, yes. But like, yeah, no, Naomi's book is one I wanted to point out.
Okay.
And yeah, so I got that whole spiel in, but, and it's true, at least to me. Yeah, it's just, we'll see where we're going. Let's see if I'm right. But again, it's wide open right now, and I think there are a lot of interesting things that are going on, you know, even when you look at the Hugos and how that all ended up panning out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's been fascinating.
That's not the word I would have used, but okay.
No, I think it has been. You know, it's been frustrating, it's been upsetting, it's been disappointing, but yeah, to have the three body problem win is, I think, fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So many different levels. So many different levels. I mean, yeah, it's kind of a consensus choice. Shock. and, you know, how we got onto the ballot, let alone, you know, it winning and a book in translation and all the different facets around it. Yeah, so it's been an interesting year.
Yep.
So Jeff Vandermeer winning the Nebula.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yep, definitely. So what are you most excited about for the rest of this year and for next year? If you could talk about any specific titles, not covered by NDAs or whatever.
Well, I mean, like, talking about these little subgenres, you know, I think the little currents that are going on in fantasy, fantasy that's somewhat based or utilizes history, I think has been an interesting little subtrend from your flintlock fantasy, Brian McClellan, to
Stina.
Stuff that's, I'm sorry?
To Stina.
Stina, absolutely. Yes. Right. That's where I was going, right? For Seven Years' War. And, you know, I think there are others as well. And so for me, we've got Silver on the Road, which is post-Civil War. It's not a weird Western because it doesn't have those weird Western elements. It's really an epic fantasy set and this alternate post-Civil War U.S. where the middle territory out going west between the Mississippi and this what was traditionally the Spanish territory is run by this person where magic actually exists, and he's known as the devil, but he's not the devil. But that's the label he has on him. And you have this character who becomes the devil's left hand. Dun, dun. And she rides circuit finding out what's wrong with the land. And there's a lot that's wrong. And so you got things like that, which are really interesting, you know, and even to something as much as Six Gun Snow White, where, yeah, it's the fairy tale of Snow White, but she's playing around with like Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show at the same time. And I think all these different facets of history being used in fantasy, it's an interesting subtrend.
So how does this fit in with the move towards space opera, for example?
I don't know if there's a correlation there. I mean, I could give you something, but I don't know. Okay.
I think there's always been a correlation, though. I mean, that you know, I've talked in the past about, you know, remembering those Del Rey catalogs in the 70s, and there were always some heavy duty parallel tracks. You know, I mean, you mentioned the James Hogan book, and I remember when those first three books first came out, and I mean, that was such a, for the time and given the stuff that had come out at the time, the fact that somebody was doing something that hard but that accessible, SF-wise, it sort of brought to an end a little bit of a drought that we had had when it came to hard SF that was really being pushed as pop culture SF, with those eye-catching covers and
sure,
and really, I think he might have been, and when the author's name becomes a logo, the old Robert Silverberg syndrome, where if your name becomes a logo, you've made it to a certain point. But right. At the same time, there's always been, fantasy in its various flavors and varieties has always run a definitely parallel track to it. And while the peaks and valleys aren't always there, I think when you look at the fact that SF and fantasy have been thrown into the same macro bucket, I think that's something that's definitely benefited both, because that really didn't kick in as a hey, let's throw everything into there until, SF had been around for a while, to the extent that it is now, where you can say that a Robert Reed novel and a China Mieville novel basically are part of the same genre,
Sure.
The fact that the spectrum has just blown open as wide as it is, I think, is sort of the end result of that symbiotic relationship that's lasted as long as it has.
Okay.
Right. And, direct tangents are harder, but I think, you're definitely right. And it's great to have these kind of conversations that between books that range there, right? Where's the movement? And, there's the new weird, and where are we post-new weird? And I think that's Jeff's Annihilation trilogy. I think it's where China is now as a writer. I also think it's where I'm going with Cameron Hurley and her science fiction novel that's going to be in the fall 2016, where you have those elements, but they're stripped down. As people mature as writers. And I think these things are really interesting to see how they evolve and the correlation between fantasy and science fiction dovetail.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, if you were going to make the correlation, so I my theory that epic science fiction and a positive epic fantasy would both be great successes, then there you go. Two sides of the same coin.
To me, the balance is struck occasionally when you get somebody like Yoon-Ha Lee who will write some pretty freaky fantasy and then write even freakier space opera-y stuff and yet is immediately identifiable as the same author as soon as you pick it up.
Right.
Equally comfortable in both directions.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've confused the audience with our
postulations.
Shall we discuss what we've all been consuming of late?
Sure.
And who would like to go first?
Well, I'll go.
Hint, 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 hint.
I'll go.
Okay.
Well, I'm taking an oath here and now that I will not be discussing Sword of Sorrows, Secret Wars, or Providence until they have run to their conclusion, because that would be an hour unto itself for each one. especially Providence, which we will be talking about at great length at some point in the future.
Okay.
For reasons I still don't exactly... I was reading a Wilkie Collins story, and in the introduction it mentioned something about the fact that he was riffing off something from Mysteries of Adolfo by Anne Radcliffe, and I said, really, he is? And so I went back and started rereading Mysteries of Adolfo, and four volumes later I had forgotten how much I like it. It's a lot of really good scenery chewing and a lot of it's obviously considered like the, to a great extent, like the seminal Gothic horror novel, but it, there's just so much that it brought in, and I can only imagine the impact it had at the time. Yes, I enjoyed that a great deal. Yeah, a lot of clutching the pearls and stuff like that throughout the course of the book. I read Clockwork Lives by Kevin J. Anderson and Neil Peart, which is the anthology of short stories of secondary characters from the Clockwork Angels novelization, which is the novelization of the Last Rush album. If you can follow that train of thought, it's pretty good. He writes in the introduction sort of how it came about, but basically a lot of the characters that are sort of walkthrough characters. Clockwork Angels, the novel, had a bit of a Phantom Tollbooth feel to it, where they go from one place to another and meet all these various interesting entities who are up to no good or too much good. And Clockwork Lives kind of breaks that down and gives us a number of stories with a nice little framework as well. It was pretty interesting. At any other time, any other place, it probably would have been marketed as a YA book. I think both of them would have been. But the fact that they were dealing with the prog rock audience as their leverage into a readership, I think kind of derailed that. I read Pelquin's Comet by Ian Waitz, which is the first volume of his Dark Angel series, which is pretty good. However, immediately after that, I went back and read Cost to Be Wise by Maureen F. McHugh, which I found an anthology of Gardner Dozois, the Mammoth Book of Short SF Novels, I believe it's called, and it was in there, and I had never read it. And it kind of surprised me because it did remind me a lot of like the 80s SF that George R. R. Martin was doing, you know, with Night Flyers and Song for Life and stuff like that. I was actually a bit surprised how much it reminded me of that, but it was really good, and it kind of dumped all my other space opera reading, sort of put it in the, not space opera, but planetary exploration and stuff like that. Kind of knocked it to the back seat for a while. Really, really, really wowed me. A couple comics got to talk about. First issues of The Spire by Simon Spurrier and Jeff Stokely came out. And another book called Tokyo Ghost by Rick Remender and Sean Murphy. Both are pretty good. The first issues came out, but they both strike me as more using the furniture of science fiction than actually being science fiction stories. But it's comics. It's a visual medium. I get why that type of storytelling is really attractive to a lot of creators. But they both had me hooked enough, and I will continue reading them. Something that is definitely not just using the furniture, though, has been Omega Men by DC. We're up to 4 issues, and they have confirmed that it is going to go 12 issues. Originally, it was going to be canceled, I think, with number 9. A very interesting revisionist history, not quite a reboot of the Omega Men from the 80s regarding a rebellion. And so far it's been pretty good. It hasn't quite veered into grimdark yet, but it certainly doesn't look like it's going to be a very happy book. Speaking of happy books, the second issue of Godzilla in Hell was fully painted by Bob Eagleton and is one of the most beautiful things I've seen comic book wise in a while. It's just basically, it's Godzilla in Hell fighting other monsters by Bob Eagleton. What more do you need? I have an observation to make regarding both Letter 44 and The Fuse, both of which we've talked about on this show before.
I'm sitting down.
Huh?
I'm sitting down.
Okay. I'm really enjoying the new storyline in The Fuse, and I'm really enjoying where Letter 44 is going for. It's had a fairly regular delivery of oh shit moments, and I think it's done it really well. However, I'm noticing that in both books, the artwork is kind of taking a much looser aesthetic now that a lot of the set pieces have been established, and now that a lot of the actual visual language of the books has been kind of put up. The artists are kind of spreading their wings and experimenting a little bit, especially in the Fuse, the last two issues of the Fuse in the storyline. He's been deceptively simplistic in depicting his backgrounds. I think he's given you like one or two shots to give you a sense of where you are, and then he's almost like completely eschewing backgrounds for whole pages where he's got characters doing dialogue and stuff like that. And he's really starting to loosening up. The one thing I don't like about it is that he's getting a touch more Justin Greenwood in the Fuse is getting a touch more cartoony, especially in the last issue with like some distorted faces and stuff like that. And I really don't think he needs to be going there. Inversely, Alberto Albuquerque in Letter 44 has actually been tightening up his characterizations and the way he's doing the aliens and stuff like that. But at the same
spoiler,
Spoiler. But at the same time, well, it's not really a spoiler. We've known.
I'm just playing with you. Sorry.
I'll get the spoilers in a second. Trust me. But at the same time, he's kind of saying, okay, everybody knows what everything looks like. Let's try to get more into the actual physical choreography of what's going on and stuff like that. And it's weird. It's subtle, but it's something I really, really noticed. Strangely enough, it's something that I found very apparent reading them on an e-reader as well, reading them on a tablet. I said, this book has a different look to it, and it's not a change in color palette. It's just sort of the dynamic between the characters and the backgrounds. Not necessarily good or bad, just something that I noticed. The comic, though, that really made the biggest impact, first issue, it's an Ashley Wood project written by Chris Ryle, drawn by Nelson Daniel. It is called String Divers, and it is about a group of androids who are shrunk down to the quantum level to try to look at the environment of quantum strings. And when they get down there, the environment is much different than what they expect to find. First issue, basically, the first half is their mission, and the second half is them briefing people in the real world as to what's going on. And yeah, it was really good. Once again, it's kind of loose on the artwork, but it's got some really funky visuals and a very interesting premise. And given the fact that the androids' characterizations are so casual, it obviously has me wondering what's the scoop what's the deal with these androids? Are they human brains or what? Which rolls me into my last little mini rant here. I want to talk about Mr. Robot, because when I was down in South Carolina taking care of my brother and in the midst of a very unhappy place, watching the first two episodes of Mr. Robot was kind of one of those, what is this, I wonder? And watching the rest of the season, and I am going to have a couple mild spoilers here for people that haven't seen it. Watching the rest of the season really drew me in for a lot of different reasons. Number one, the fact that the show was so upfront about having an unreliable narrator. Number two, the fact that it had such a great slate of supporting characters that managed to make a nice little smooth spectrum of personality types that sort of ran in the background of Elliot, the main character. The other thing that's really impressive that a lot of people have talked about, but it really needs to be mentioned, is the fact that Sam Esmail really established a visual narrative style that was immediately recognizable and very unique. And I have to think back to stuff like Twin Peaks and Parker Lewis Can't Lose to the last time a show really was recognizable within a couple seconds of turning it on just by the visuals that were being done. But he's doing this all while going out of his way to really ape his favorite directors. There's homages left and right, but he still manages to look. They're not as distracting as they could be. That being said, I was really, really unhappy, and I've actually become visibly angry thinking about the last episode for the last few weeks, primarily because it opened quite literally with an anticlimax, which I thought was rather clever the way it was done, but then spent the next hour, 10 minutes, not really giving us any new information, given how many threads were in the air. None of them were resolved, and very few of them were actually addressed. And it also gave us two very, very cliched speeches by characters about yay for anarchy and hey, modern life sucks. And they were both very, very cliched speeches, which kind of landed right in the middle like turds in the middle of the episode. And it was sort of, it was a lot of eye rolling on the part of this man. So I'm in for season two, definitely. And I'm assuming that a lot of this were changes that were made due to the fact that the show did get renewed about halfway through its run. And that's understandable, and I applaud that. You know, you don't want to wrap everything up. But at the same time, he managed to dazzle enough that a lot of people didn't notice that he really didn't deliver on a lot of the promise of the show. And where he goes in season two is certainly going to be something that I kind of fixate on, because in giving us the unreliable narrator and quite slash not quite breaking the fourth wall at the same time, it was enough to draw you in. But once you got us in the door, he didn't bother to feed us or give us hors d'oeuvres or let us use the bathroom or anything. It was a bit of a mess in my eyes, but it looked gorgeous. It was a gorgeous mess. It looked gorgeous. So that's everything for me.
You might want to look up, I think it's the previous episode of The Incomparable. They talk about both humanoids and Mr. Robot.
Okay.
So you might want to give that a listen, because they've got some interesting perspective on the shows.
All right. I will do that.
John, you next, or you want me to go?
I'll be next. Why not? Last show, I sort of talked about a couple things I was in the process of reading, like Stories for Chip and A Borrowed Man and The Sorcerer of the Crown, and I since finished them all, thankfully. And I sort
of The Crown, too. That's right. I forgot that.
Yep. So my initial misgivings about A Borrowed Man were unfortunately fully borne out by the rest of the book. It's getting good reviews, and I guess I don't understand why. It's like people are saying, oh, it's sort of a mystery and cryptic things are said and they're unsettling things the guy says. I'm like, that's not a novel. I mean, it's so, as I sort of said last time, it's on one level it's sort of a very straightforward kind of mystery, but then, you know, kind of, I guess, spoiler alert, the mystery doesn't really matter. Which I guess is very Wolfian. but again, it felt very slow and was hard to discern the significance of things. It was very un-Wolfian in a lot of ways. And, you know, it's great when an author tries something different, but in this case, it just didn't have the feeling of being, I don't know, really thoroughly thought out. There are things that happen that you go, would they really do that? Things just didn't mesh oftentimes. So I was ended up being sort of a mediocre experience for me, which I think is the first time a Wolf book has really done that for me. Really just not been that exciting. Stories for Chip ended up liking better than I thought I would, actually. I wasn't sure what it would be like. I mean, I knew it was going to be a bunch of different tributes, and, you know, I'd gotten a preview of the book, and I interviewed Nissy Shaw about it. But I was really surprised at how good a lot of the entries were and how they showed a lot of different ways that Chip has influenced creative people. So that was really nice to read. That was really nice to see. And there's some real standout pieces in it. Hal Duncan's was possibly my favorite, though there were a couple of others that were really great. And the variety of approaches too was really nice. A few felt like, you know, sort of pastiches of Delaney, but others really just sort of were authors doing their own thing and sort of showing through their work what they had sort of learned from him. And you could pick on that quite strongly a lot of times. So I was really impressed, actually. I mean, I figured I would like it because of the subject, but I ended up liking it much more than I actually thought I would. So that was nice. Zen Show Swords of the Crown I finished, and it was good. It felt a little too mannered for my taste. It felt a little slow in places. I mean, just sort of minor things. But it was, on another level, it was fun to see her playing with some of the stuff she was playing with in the book. And how sort of colonialism and race and other stuff got blended into the story in a way that didn't feel forced or lecturing. So that was nice too. Things were actually pretty well integrated in the story. So that was nice to see. So I enjoyed it. And I'm curious what the next one will be like. And then for other things that I read after that, I'm doing some research for something I'm writing, and I picked up a cheap book at the bookstore. It's called The Bazaar: Markets, Emergence of the Islamic World, which turned out to be a terrific book. Totally worth the dollar I paid for it. And what it is basically a tour of all the a number of major markets and bazaars in the Islamic world. So you go to North Africa, you go to the Middle East. It ranges pretty widely. The photography is really good. I mean, not just in terms of technical precision, but it's really interesting what they choose to photograph. There's definitely sort of a sort of demystification of the stereotype of what an Islamic bazaar is like. So you see people working, you see different types of shops, you see people in, logo t-shirts and stuff. It really resists exoticizing the topic. And there's a lot of great information both about the specific places and the evolution of some of these markets and how both economics and politics can play in sometimes. And how they're not just sort of cute cultural expressions, but they're really, really important aspects of the societies that use them. And so it was very valuable to me, and it was a pleasure to see the photographs, and the writing is actually pretty good too. So that was quite nice. And then I read a couple of graphic novels, unfortunately. So the first one I read is a pretty recent thing. It came out in maybe May, and it's the hardcover Spider-Verse compilation.
Oh God. Oh, why, John, you should have called me. I would have talked to you, man.
Well, I just barred it. I didn't buy it, so I can bring it back. It's okay. I got it partly because my daughter likes Spider-Man a lot, and I was kind of wondering if some of it would be worth her reading. And I'd never actually heard of this sort of event before. I'd kind of missed it, mercifully. So I So I was curious. I was like, it's sort of like a sort of Crisis of Infinite Spider People. And I thought, well, maybe that could be good. And I like Dan Slott's work a lot. I love what he's doing with Silver Surfer right now with Mike Allred. So I was like, well, he's one of the writers, so maybe that'll, and it was terrible. Right from the very first scene with the Spider-Man in Shakespearean time.
Yes.
I knew where it was going. I knew what was going to happen. Part of the problem is it was a very predictable storyline. And I can't fault it for its ridiculousness and excess, because it's a comic book. Those are two of the frequently utilized characteristics of a comic book. but I can fault it for just not being, for not being cohesive. It's like, you know, they have this long story arc they're kind of telling with a lot of different characters, but I often felt it didn't matter which spider character was doing something. Mm-hmm. There was not as, like, they're graphically they're represented very diversely, but, you know, it's like most of them just take orders from Spider-Man, and others are just almost like cogs. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the funny thing, I guess spoiler alert, about the Shakespearean Spider-Man is that you know him for 2 minutes and then he's eaten. So it's like, this is how it's going to be. You're going to introduce characters and make them, you know, a little sympathetic because we know that it's a spider person, and then you're going to eliminate them. I'm like, just, I didn't even finish it. It's just was not
there's
worth it.
A little too much trying to imbue significance in a character that has always, you know, had a history of being the everyman and stuff like that, to really
throw
this amount of baggage into it was just kind of, okay, sure.
Yeah, it felt wrong. It just felt wrong.
Yeah.
So that was Spider-Verse. And then I read a French comic called Sept Guerrières, which means Seven Female Warriors. And I was intrigued because of the cover, which had them in mostly, you know, decent armor and stuff, and sort of suggested it was going to be all about them being warriors. Some of them had boob armor, which is a little off-putting. But I decided to read it anyway. It took me a little while because my French is not great. But I got through it. And it was monumentally okay.
It excelled in its mediocrity. So.
Something like that. I mean, the art wasn't bad. It did what it was supposed to do. It wasn't particularly evocative. A problem is basically they use hairstyles to differentiate the warriors because they almost all have the same body type. There's not a lot. There's some variation, but not a lot. And especially in battle, you can almost couldn't tell who's who without that, you know, without that marker. And then the story was potentially interesting, but it was sort of like, you know, between warring nations in the 6th century, there's this magical little kingdom of white people. Basically like in sort of between Persia and another country, there's this little enclave of magical white people. We're beset at all sides by the evil brown people. And the story is basically these seven women warriors trying to get their prince out of the country into safety. And the story wasn't that great. The characters were not well drawn. The battle scenes were really actually the best thing, because one thing that I thought they did do right was portray battles pretty well. And it's nice to see, you know, female warriors kicking ass always. But it just didn't really come together, and the ending kind of pissed me off. So it was remarkably, you know, eh.
Sounds worse than that, but okay.
Well, there's some things I liked. It wasn't a total disaster. But, you know, it's not just these are seven warriors. They're seven sexy warriors. So we get lots of unnecessary instances of lovemaking in the nude. And I'm like, that's not a problem for me. But it's like, if it doesn't serve the story, I'm like, oh, what do we do now? Let's have a sex scene. That'll work. Yeah, let's do that. So, yeah. And that is what I have finished. I'm reading Teresa Frohawk's new book. I'm trying to remember the name of right now. It's kind of a cool name. And it's Midnight Silence. In Midnight Silence. And I'm liking it so far. I think she's a pretty strong writer, and I'm interested in the world that she's building. So that's kind of nice. And I'm reading something else at the moment. Another novel. What is it? It's really sad that I can't remember off the top of my head. Nope, can't remember. That's not good. But I'm also finishing the latest Masters of Science Fiction volume by Edward James, which is about Lois McMaster Bujold. And rather like Karen Burnham's volume on Greg Eden, I already want to explore Bujold's work more as a result of reading this book. So I think hers is a little better. It does things a little differently and all that, but I think this is really well done because James obviously, you know, admires Bujold's work a great deal, but he's not being slavish in his praise. And these are often, his analyses are often really well balanced. So I think it's actually a really good addition to a series that has mostly disappointed me.
Yeah. Yep.
So I get that. And then Letters to Tiptree I just started. From our guest of last month. And I've only just read the first couple of entries and I'm intrigued. And I've read some of the bits that were put out beforehand and I think it's, I'm looking forward to exploring it and seeing what they have to say. And that's it.
Mr. Monty, or would you prefer that I go next?
I can go.
Okay.
Counter to your, I'll move my list around a little bit. Counter to your French comic. I finally read Rat Queens. Finally, so I'm jumping the bandwagon on this.
Oh, one. Yeah.
That's terrific. I really thought it was going to be bad. And it turned out to be kind of great.
It could be, but it works.
Yes, I just thought it would be bad. I was expecting bad boob armor and all the things that you were complaining about. And no, it's smarter. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was a real treat. And then, so Zencho was actually somebody I chased after when I was an agent. So I read Sorcerer to the Crown, an early draft, a while ago, and I'm so glad it's getting received well. Her playing around with Regency romance and colonialism and all, I think is really smart, and that your heroic character turns out not to be the heroic character, and instead it's her, and both of them are pains in the butt, right? And
so right.
For different reasons, and... not very heroic. And yeah, I think it's great. That's great. Jess, so like you, I'm looking forward to seeing where she goes with book two. And I mentioned I picked up Nora Jemison's fifth season today, which sounds like it's sci-fi mashed up with fantasy. And I think, you know, Nora is such a good writer, so I'm looking to see where she's playing with on this. It's really hard for me to keep up with things. I'm reading so many manuscripts for work, right? And as Ken Liu was, which is what I'm embroiled in right now, is book two of his. 250 or 260,000 words first draft. So, yay! But, you know, other things I want to, like, pick up, just as far as books, next week and hopefully then read at some point. Overdue a Tracy Spiff's memoir. I want to read Mary Carr's book on memoir. I got to pick up the revised version of Steering the Craft from Le Guin. So it's such a good book.
Yep.
I guess the other thing that I started recently was Sense 8. I finally got to watch some of that. You know, I like it, and then there are parts of it that are just like, oh, God. Get on with it already. And this has no point. And I threw a shout out to a few writer friends and who talked about it on another podcast and how much they like it. I'm like, really? Should I keep going? It's on episode 4. And I know it's Straczynski, and I like Straczynski's stuff, but like, that's the slow roll with him. But
yeah, I talked about that a little bit last month, that I it was frustrating in the fact that it could have gelled a lot sooner than it did, but when it does gel, it gels really, really well.
Yeah. Okay.
And given the fact that this thing is shot on every continent and has as many characters as it does, the thing that kind of bounced around a little bit for me was the fact that there were just character actions and character behaviors that I really felt needed explaining, especially the number of really stupid things that people do or do not do. But I watched it through to the end, and it held me, and my mind is already going in a million different ways it could go in season two. But
that's what everyone tells me. So yes, I'll stick with it. But it's good to know you also agree. Yeah, because I'm frustrated by the Mexican actors. I'm like, oh, you're all beautiful, but who cares? By the extremity of what, me and names tonight, with Nomi and what happened with her and how before she escapes from the hospital, spoiler, sorry. That whole—it's not. Yeah, there are issues, and there are really bad issues, but it's not that crazy. You can't just perform surgery on somebody, and as an adult, have your mother sign off on it.
Well, there's a—that's sort of one of the first symptoms of the fact that there's more going on than.
Yeah, I know, but still, it's just like you're just leading us along. Where's the rope you're pulling on? You know, it's. You know, it's just like, okay, you could have done this a smarter way. And yeah, I guess, I assumed as much at least, that yeah, it's that mysterious guy there who comes in on Daryl Hannah at the end, right? But whatever, right. So I'm going to keep going at some point when I have all my free time. That's when I'll finish Daredevil and all those other things I haven't watched yet, like Game of Thrones last season. The last thing was I listened to Chris Rush on the Good Street podcast this week, and I thought she said a lot of really smart things. She was talking about an anthology she's working on of female authors writing fantasy, science fiction, and other tangible genres, and she's working on with Bane, and what are different nuances, what's going on in the field now from her perspective. And I thought that was really smart and positive and actionable. So that's my recent stuff, or semi-recent, at least with Zen. So on to you, Fred.
Okay.
Oh, actually, I got a question, though. So Omega Man, Jeff.
Yeah.
How different from Lethem's stuff from 7-8 years ago? Vastly.
How different from what?
Lethem's Omega Man stuff.
A whole lot.
Okay.
It's quite frankly, I'm not certain if we're supposed to, if there's any continuity with earlier iterations at all, at this point, given the fact that they just came off. You know, between the new 52 and Convergence earlier this year, right?
Sure.
So the only thing that is really pre-established is what's his name? The Green Lantern. God, the cartoonist Green Lantern there. The second, I can't remember the secret identity's name, but his presence in the system. It's a bit of a rebellion story, but obviously there's something bigger going on. It is not slapping you in the face like the original one. It is not diving into a lot of superhero tropes the way the original book did, but it's also I hesitate to call it weird, but at the same time, it's kind of using the furniture, like I said before.
All right. Cool.
It's a interesting take.
Fun. Thanks.
Okay. Since last month's episode, I'm now at 721 short works for the year and 113 long works. One that I haven't finished that I really recommend is The Making of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey by Piers Bizony, B-I-Z-O-N-Y. Previously available in some multi-hundred-dollar volume, which included like a steel vault, slipcase, and the complete shooting script. This one doesn't have either of those features, but has like 90% of everything that appeared in the original edition, and is only $46.
Is this Taschen put out?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you've got pages in there that will fold out, and your jaw is just going to drop. I mean, the pre-production artwork, pictures of the sets, stills from the movie, behind the scenes stuff, all these pictures of all these guys filming wearing suit jackets and ties and everything. Like, it's just, and everyone's smoking, of course, except for Arthur C. Clarke, I think, is the only person that never smoked in any of these pictures. But it's just an astounding amount of work detailing, you know, what is still one of my favorite movies of all time. So I recommend that heartily. I probably should have saved this for our end of the year wish list episode, but, you know, buy it before it disappears. Books read since last month. I reread Islands in the Sky and Dolphin Island by Arthur C. Clarke on one weekend when I was dealing with some stuff. I just couldn't read anything more deep or more recent. And those were both fun. Otherwise, mostly what I've been reading is I'm still working my way through the BPRD series by Mike Mignola and company. Mm-hmm. I'm up to, I think, volume 9 or volume 10 of the Hell on Earth series. And God, are we poor humans ever going to win? I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, one monster after another, and things keep getting worse. And I mean, I love the art, but it's just like, I feel like I'm in an endless game of Call of Cthulhu, and my sanity just keeps dropping. Also read The Big Time by Fritz Lieber for the first time in many years.
Yeah.
And that was a very strange experience. And the...
Why?
It's almost like... I'm not sure whether he was writing a tribute to Heinlein in many ways, or Heinlein's later stuff is a tribute to Lieber.
Oh, fascinating.
You know, especially The Number of the Beast and this one, I think, are very close in style.
I'll agree with you there.
And I think all Fritz Lieber overall, I just think, was a better short story or shorter work author than a novel writer. Because it always just seems to, his longer stuff just seems to run out of coherence at some point. On the other hand, Fritz Lieber on a bad day is better than most guys on a good day.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think for a collection, my favorite still remains his Ghost Light that Byron Pierce Visual Productions did years ago. Mm-hmm. And for short stories, I still love the Fafford stories, I think, the most of his stuff. And I prefer for the Spider Wars stories, of which this is the novel version, I think I prefer the stories over the novel. He just sustains his energy better in those short works.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished today a book called The Complete Griselda, which is by a guy named Oliver Dickinson, and it is a series of short stories set in the fantasy role-playing game universe of RuneQuest, of which I am trying to reabsorb enough background in order to run an online game. And some of the players may include a Nebula Award-nominated author, a guy who is currently designing a role-playing game for a famous webcomic, a author who writes for Warhammer 40,000, and some guy in upstate New York who works in a bookstore. Among others.
Boy, why'd you invite that schlub?
I don't know. You got me. And that's where I stand.
Wow.
So, any final thoughts? Starting with our illustrious Fourth Horseman.
Let's see.
We got to put him to bed soon because, you know, he's got to be up at 5 o'clock and start editing, right?
Oh, I'm gonna start editing as soon as we hang up, so to speak. What are you talking about? Seriously. I am. Gotcha. Got to get the hours in when I can. There's no editing done in the office. I once tweeted that I was editing in the office, and everyone just made fun of me. All the other editors like, yeah, enjoy it while you can. That's not going to happen any longer, and it's true. I guess the other thing that's been happening that's been interesting is just how much of the genre has bled out into the non-genre. You know, with the infamous Ishiguro and St. John Mandel's book, and David Mitchell, who's always been writing this, but now was open about it and accepted. And then Salman Rushdie's new book is a fantasy novel, right? And it's interesting where we are. The Martian, which was not published as science fiction per se, and here it is like the book of the year. It's everywhere, which I think is both interesting and could be problematic in a few years if it all explodes too much.
I'll do you one better there. I made a joke a while back about, listening to a lot of story podcasts where the story I was reading had less elements of the fantastic in it than your average Hallmark movie. And somebody called me out on it, so I went and I read the listings for everything that was showing on Hallmark Movie Network for the next 48 hours. And I would say roughly 2 out of every 3 films had some element of the fantastic in it.
Yeah.
On the Hallmark channel. So.
Yeah, no, it's so ubiquitous, and that's why I think it's interesting that that's where we're going. And maybe maybe that's the correlation on space opera and positive fantasy, that it is mainstream. It's interesting that this is what we're exploring in many ways in art. So that's, I guess, my last thought to chew on.
Okay. John?
Final thoughts?
Okay, we broke John.
Done?
Yep. We're done.
No, I mean, the only final thought I have is that it's always interesting to discuss the patterns that people see in the publishing world. Like, what's going to hit and what's not going to, and because it says so much about the person themselves, but also the kind of images the market itself generates. So I find that always interesting to talk about. So, yeah, this was a great conversation because I think we really got to some of that stuff in the conversation. So.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yeah. No, I agree with all the above. I will be at Capclave in a couple weeks, hopefully for all 3 days. It's a very short drive for me up the road, and my list of meet space meetings is actually getting longer as we on almost a daily basis, so I'm looking forward to it. It's been given the year so far, I'm looking forward to a con. So
good. Well,
I'm wearing my Three Horsemen t-shirt. I'll be easy to spot, so.
Well, I am still on track for attending HonorCon at the end of October. I forgot to mention, that's right. Final thoughts. My daughter has read Zen Cho, Kate Elliott, and Fran Wilde all in like the past 2 weeks.
Wow.
Oh, did she read the Court of Fives?
Yes, she did. She enjoyed it a lot. And of course, she managed to ask me to ask each author when's the next one coming out. So I guess they were hits.
Cool.
So well,
she has good taste.
I'm trying. Yeah, I'm trying to build the next generation here. So there we go. Build your next generations, everyone. So thank you all for listening, And thank you, Joe, for joining us this evening. I'm looking forward to seeing everything that comes out from Saga over the next however many years.
Many, hopefully. Yes. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. It was great. Thanks.
And good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.